Israel's military is planning to attack Hamas, and it's telling more than a million Palestinians in northern Gaza to get out of the way.
So those who want to save their life, please go south.
The United Nations is warning of a humanitarian catastrophe for the Gaza Strip. In Poland, the populist ruling party has taken some steps that many see as anti-democratic and divisive.
I don't think our society was this polarized ever since the transition from 1990s.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. New rules for soccer are winning people over in Spain. Get this, no running allowed.
Evitar correr. Claro, después de tantos años
the hardest
corriendo.
Part, this player says, is not breaking into a sprint. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. Our top story is in the Middle East, where the Israel Defense Forces said its troops and tanks carried out small raids into the Gaza Strip today, and the IDF continued to bomb the area. Palestinian health officials put the death toll in Gaza at 1,800 people since this past weekend. A much larger ground invasion by Israel's military is expected soon. Hundreds of thousands of Israeli troops are moving into position in southern Israel. Earlier today, the IDF told Palestinians to evacuate their homes in northern Gaza. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was in Tel Aviv today meeting with his Israeli counterpart, Yoav Gallant. Gallant said the evacuation order is intended to separate Palestinian civilians from Hamas.
So those who want to save their life, please go south. We are going to destroy Hamas infrastructures, Hamas headquarters, Hamas military establishment, and take this phenomena out of Gaza and out of the earth. They cannot live among human civilized people.
More than a million Palestinians live in northern Gaza. The United Nations today sounded a warning about this evacuation order, saying it will lead to, quote, devastating humanitarian consequences. To hear more from the Palestinian perspective, I spoke with Deanna Boutou. She's a Palestinian lawyer and a former official with the Palestine Liberation Organization and joined us from the Israeli city of Nazareth. Deanna, what goes through your mind when you're thinking about Israel's call for Palestinians to evacuate northern Gaza?
This harkens back to the Nakba. This is the mass expulsion of Palestinians. You know, I have a personal story with this as well. My late father was 9 years old in 1948, and his mother, my late grandmother, was a person who had to make the same decision that many Palestinians today are making, whether to flee their cities, their villages, and towns to go to safety or to remain. And this is exactly what Palestinians in Gaza are now experiencing. And what my friends are telling me on the phone is they're terrified. They're afraid that if they leave their houses, they'll never be able to go back. And they're terrified that even if they do leave, that they'll be bombed along the way. So this is really harkening back for Palestinians, for the Nakba, especially in the Gaza Strip, which is 80% of the people who live in the Gaza Strip are themselves refugees. So it's making refugees yet another generation of refugees. There isn't a safe place for anybody in Gaza.
Now, the Israeli military says this order is about preserving Palestinian lives, so it can destroy military infrastructure built by Hamas. How do Palestinians see the order?
It's quite the opposite. They don't want to preserve our lives. They've been saying that they want us to flee, but there is no conditions that are there for people to leave. There is no humanitarian corridor. There are no guarantees that Palestinians will be able to come back. Israel has already bombed the roads and has cut off the fuel supplies, cut off water, cut off electricity. So there is no safe place to go. And this is why agencies like the UN are calling upon Israel to rescind this, because there is no way that this can be done in a safe manner.
The details of the Hamas attack over the past weekend in southern Israel are, of course, horrific. As you learned about what was happening at the time, what was going through your mind?
So I was shocked. But then I also wasn't surprised, because I knew that this had been brewing. I and other Palestinians have been saying to the international community, to Israel, to anybody who will listen, that the occupation is cancer. And as much as Israel tries to think that it has control, it doesn't. And the idea that the only way that they can have security is if Palestinians feel insecure is not a recipe that is sustainable. It never has been and never will be. Very shortly thereafter, it hit me and dawned on me that Palestinians are going to pay a very, very, very heavy price.
The Israeli response to the Hamas attack has, as you said, obviously been devastating for people in Gaza and will continue to be. What do you think it would take to de-escalate or take a step back from this conflict right now?
It requires the U.S. and other world leaders to come in, step in and say enough is enough, and not just to call for a ceasefire, but to get to the root causes of this. And the root causes are this 75 years of living in refugee camps and 56 years of living under military occupation.
This is the fifth war fought between Israel and Hamas since 2006, but what's happening now is being described as unprecedented in many ways. What do you think has changed or will change big picture in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
So in the bigger picture, all I see as somebody who lives inside Israel is, again, a greater dehumanization process against all Palestinians. You know, yet we're hearing reports of Palestinians who are being killed in the West Bank, who are being harassed and beaten inside Israel. You know, this is a place that is probably the most covered in history. It's certainly the most documented in terms of human rights organizations. People know what's happening, and yet the world has failed us. And if anything is going to change now, people are getting this sense that nobody is there to protect us and we have to protect ourselves.
We've been focusing, of course, on Hamas and Gaza. The Palestinian leadership in the West Bank is seen as weak and ineffective by many Palestinians. Is there a leadership vacuum among Palestinians? And if so, why is that?
The Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, he was elected as president back in 2005. We haven't had elections since, even though his term was to have ended in 2009. And the problem with him is that he isn't actually serving as a leader. He's been somebody who spent his years in office wagging his finger at us, telling us what not to do, but never really standing up for Palestinians and actually pushing for our freedom, pushing for our liberation. And so this is where we see that there's a lack of real leadership on his part. And because he spent so many years in office, he's actually spent his years trying to crush any opposition to him.
Last question, Deanna. There are more than 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip now. What does the future look like for them?
Sheer misery. You know, of the 2.2 million Palestinians who live there, over a million of them are children under the age of 18. These are kids who've never seen a day of freedom, who've lived in the equivalent of an open-air prison. But there's also something else, which is there's a real desire to live, and they want to have a future, but when you live your whole life in the equivalent of an open-air prison, an open cage, the chances of you having that wonderful life are next to nothing. And this is the part that's so tragic, is that Israel has crushed the hopes and the dreams of 2.2 million Palestinians, but especially over a million children.
Deanna Boutu is a Palestinian lawyer and academic. She joined us from Nazareth in Israel. Deanna, thank you.
Thank you very much.
For 8 years, Poland has been ruled by a populist political party that has stripped away power from the country's courts, introduced a near total ban on abortion, and taken control of the state broadcaster. Polls show that governing party as the frontrunner ahead of a general election this weekend. But the race appears to be a close one. And as the World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports, getting an accurate picture of the political situation inside Poland is not always easy.
In early October, hundreds of thousands of people marched through the centre of Warsaw. It was the biggest anti-government rally the Polish capital had seen since the 1980s and the mass demonstrations against communism. Warsaw city authorities said around a million people turned out that day. But Poland's public sector broadcaster, TVP said only around 100,000 people showed up. This doesn't surprise journalist Dorota Nigren. She worked as an editor for Polish radio in Warsaw for 15 years. And when the current government came into power back in 2015, she says, things started to change.
We were hearing during editorial meetings what we shall cover, what we not shall cover, what kind of guests should we invite to the programs.
Her newsroom colleagues started to shy away from covering certain topics that didn't align with government policy. Or if they did, she says, they didn't want their names attached to the story.
It was kind of horrific because they were just very afraid of losing their jobs.
In 2017, Nigren was asked to write up a report about an attack on a priest in Italy. The attacker was Moroccan. Nigren left that detail out, she says. She didn't feel it was relevant to the report. A couple of days later, she was called into her boss's office. He told her the attacker's nationality was crucial to the story and threatened to fire her over the incident. But instead, Nigren was demoted to working in the radio's archives department. Part of her was relieved, she says, that she was no longer in the newsroom, but she was embarrassed too.
It was also a degradation. In front of the eyes of my colleagues, I was just like kicked out, you know.
Nigren no longer works for that news agency. And she says when she listens to the state broadcaster now, she hears negative stories about migrants all the time. The Polish government has added 4 referendum questions to this Sunday's election ballot. 2 of them are about migration. Paulina Lenik in Krakow says it's a typical campaign tool by the ruling party.
Even if the electorate will not say it out loud, they are very wary of illegal migration. And these people that are not really decided on which party they would vote for. Migration is one of this kind of thing that might swing a voter towards you.
Around 4.5 million voters are reported to be undecided about Sunday's election. And Lenik, who's an expert on populism in Central Europe, says including these sorts of ballot questions about migration will likely help the government party. It's known for its anti-immigrant rhetoric. Lenik says the whole election campaign has been really divisive in Poland.
I don't think our society was this polarized ever since the transition from 1990s. And you have the sense of the government placing people at 2 sides of the barricade. So you're either with us or you're against us.
On one side of that barricade is the ruling Law and Justice Party, known in Poland as PiS. On the other, the Civic Coalition, led by Donald Tusk, a former Polish Prime Minister and EU Council President. Political expert Jakub Jaruzelski says the ruling party likes to depict Donald Tusk as something of a stooge for the German government.
PiS is definitely trying to tap into a small but vocal segment of Polish society, which is strongly anti-German and is trying to present this election as an opportunity to defend Polish sovereignty against Germany, against the European Union, and painting Donald Tusk as more of a foreign agent.
Jaruzelski, who's with the think tank Democracy Reporting International, says Sunday's contest is still too close to call. Security concerns with the war in neighbouring Ukraine and anger over the government's abortion ban have featured in the campaign, but Jaruzelski says you can't underestimate the support the Polish government still commands. And he says there's at least one obvious reason for this.
People now in 2023 are much well off than they were in 2015. Of course, not everyone, but in general, people can now afford much more than they could almost a decade ago.
It's the paradox of this government, Jakub Jaruzelski says. Salaries are up, but democracy and basic human rights are continually being eroded, he says. And on Sunday, the Polish people will have to decide what matters most. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
You're with The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. You're with The World. Tomorrow, Australians will finally have their say. The vote on whether to change the constitution to recognise Indigenous Australians for the first time. The referendum would establish a new advisory body called the Aboriginal Voice to Parliament, which would advise the government on issues that affect Aboriginal communities. The debate around this amendment has brought a stew of misinformation, confusion, and racism. As The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports from Sydney, it was not supposed to get so ugly. Here's the final part in our series on the Indigenous Voice to Parliament.
In 2022, Australia's newly elected Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, went to the Garma Festival, which is Australia's largest Indigenous conference. He came with a big announcement. The country is ready for reform, he said.
I believe the tide is running our way. I believe the momentum is with us as never before.
In a speech to hundreds of Indigenous leaders and advocates, many of whom had been waiting years for this, Albanese laid out the draft wording for the amendment, and he made a prediction.
Fundamentally, this is a reform I believe every Australian can embrace. Enshrining a voice will be a national achievement. It will be above politics.
Famous last words.
I think the people of Australia are going to rise up. I think people are actually fed up with all of this woke rubbish.
I don't need anyone's white guilt.
What happened? Political analysts say Albanese wasn't crazy to think this could have been a unifying moment for Australia. Political parties across the spectrum say they want constitutional recognition for Aboriginal people. And in fact, the proposal for the voice came out of a consultation process that happened entirely under Conservative governments. Hannah McGlade is a Noongar woman and legal scholar at Curtin University in Perth.
Indigenous leaders who had involvement with Conservatives in Australia were led to believe that they would support this amendment to the Constitution.
And then?
And then they changed. They changed their views.
In April, opposition leader Peter Dutton and his Liberal Party frontbenchers decided to actively campaign against the voice. In Australian politics, the Liberals, capital L, are Conservative. They're the centre-right party. In a speech to the House of Representatives, Dutton called the voice a symptom of the madness of identity politics and used the words of Martin Luther King Jr. to argue the proposed amendment is racist.
The great progress of the 20th century's civil rights movements was the push to eradicate difference, to judge each other on the content of our character, not the colour of our skin.
Political analyst Mark Kenny at the Australian National University in Canberra says Dutton's motivations for opposing the voice are clear. Dutton wants to be prime minister.
He's in a very weak position politically, and he sees this as his ticket to damaging Anthony Albanese and the Labor government, and therefore advancing his chances of remaining in charge of his party and going on to be prime minister.
And he's doing it, says Kenny, by appealing to disaffected white voters by playing to racial and class resentments.
I think it takes leaps out of Trump's playbook and probably also takes some guidance from what happened with Brexit in 2016. It's a very naked political gambit that he is playing here at the cost of the country.
With the support of Sky News, the 24-hour TV network owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corp.
This has become a referendum on Albanese and the Labor Party's close links to the big corporates and all the other woke organizations.
Albanese, in this speech to the Garma Festival, was demanding an Aboriginal-only parliament to turn us into an apartheid state.
The anti-voice campaign has been flooding the field with disinformation and conspiracy theories, like if the voice passes, Aboriginal Australians will take your house or take your backyards, or the voice is part of a plot by the moneyed elite to take over the country. This TikTok video is pretty typical. It stars leading No campaigner Jacinta Napijimpa-Price, who happens to be Indigenous, about what voice supporters really want.
They want to pay their respects to the Communist Party. They want reparations. They want to tear down our system.
People in the Yes campaign are now on the defensive. Last month at an info session, the prominent Indigenous leader Marsha Langton was answering questions about the voice. Someone asked her if it was true that if the voice passes, all Aboriginal people would get money. Here's Langton's response.
Every time the No case raises one of their arguments, if you start pulling it apart, you get down to base racism. I'm sorry to say it, but that's where it lands. Or just sheer stupidity.
Her comments were picked up by news outlets, tweeted out by the opposition leader, Peter Dutton, and magnified on social media, setting off clashes like this on national TV between a senator and a government minister.
Am I racist, Claire? Is that what you're saying? This referendum, Jane, that is a disgraceful thing to say. That is a disgraceful thing to say. You should be debating the referendum because the truth, that is not true.
The millions of Australians that are voting no racist, this is outrageous. The Prime Minister needs to condemn it.
I get it.
And that's basically where Australia is right now. Hannah McGlade, the Indigenous legal scholar at Curtin, says what gets drowned out in all this noise is the experience of Indigenous Australians.
Aboriginal people are political football in this country, and that's why we can't close the gap on Indigenous disadvantage. And that's why billions of dollars are wasted every year on Indigenous affairs and policies that don't work, because we're just a political football to kick around.
McGlade says it's important not to lose sight of how this referendum started as a plea for meaningful reform to improve the lives of Indigenous Australians. The vote is tomorrow, October 14th. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum in Sydney.
The indigenous population above the Arctic Circle, the Sami people, have faced their own challenges. In Norway, traditional singer Mari Boine has channeled her reaction to this treatment into her music. Boine sings in the traditional style called Joiking. Boine is a pioneer in bringing Sami music to the mainstream by fusing it with rock, and she's an advocate for Sami rights. In the 1980s, Mari Boine began reading about the history of repression of her people. For example, the government of Norway erased the Sami language from the school curriculum. Her response came through her music, as she explained in 2008 to Free Muse, the music censorship watchdog.
And then there was a volcano inside me of anger and rage that had to get out because I realized what had been done to my people. So I started to make songs about this.
The opening line in this classic by Mari Boine goes, "Hear the voices of the foremothers." The tune is called Gula Gula. You're listening to The World. The conflict in Gaza and Israel is playing out in real time for a global audience on social media, but there's a lot of misleading information.
We've seen attacks from the Syrian regime in Aleppo being repurposed and claiming that it's footage from Gaza.
How social media can add to the fog of war, that's ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. You are listening to The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX.
I think we can pull this off.
Gamers around the globe may not notice right away, but Call of Duty is being redeployed.
Run!
Diablo has a new quest. And good old Candy Crush may be crushing candies on more devices than ever. That's because Microsoft was finally approved to acquire the company that makes those games, Activision Blizzard. It's a $69 billion deal. It was finalized today after the British government dropped its objections to the acquisition. Here to explain all this is Joost van Drooyen. He teaches the business of video games at the NYU Stern School of Business. Joost, in a quick headline, what just happened?
Microsoft, after almost 2 years of wrestling with regulators, finally got approval to close its proposed acquisition of the largest North American game maker, Activision Blizzard.
Now, I understand it was a long road to get to this deal. Microsoft owns Xbox. Was one of the concerns from regulators that the games produced by this big studio would only be available on Xbox?
Correct. Initially, the regulators were very worried that a vertical integration where a platform holder, Xbox, would have exclusive access to the content from Activision would basically make life incredibly difficult for Sony with its PlayStation and everybody else in the ecosystem. And so the worry was that such exclusivity would become detrimental to the ecosystem, to the competition in the space, and ultimately, of course, raise prices for consumers. And that became a hot button topic early on in the conversation with regulators.
And many regulators have had to put their stamp of approval on this deal. Finally, today, Microsoft overcame objections by the UK regulator, Competition and Markets Authority. How did they do that?
Microsoft has made more than a few concessions. I guess on the front end, you hear, of course, these rearrangements where Ubisoft, for instance, a French publisher, is now in charge of giving out the licenses around the Call of Duty franchise so that it's not just Microsoft handling it, but it's an entire third party. They pay for that, but in return, you have a little bit more of an equitable ecosystem and a distribution of market power. And it's concessions like that that have allowed Microsoft to slowly but surely charm the watchdogs in the UK. The FTC in North America, in the US, has not yet been as charmed, but they have now enough momentum, now that the deal is approved, to actually finalize on.
Many people were concerned that this deal would give Microsoft too big a profile in gaming. How justified are those fears?
So the games market historically has been really centered around console gaming. And within that context, exclusivity to content has always been a key competitive aspect, right? That's an advantage that you build for yourself in order to draw people into your ecosystem, buy your devices, and so on.
So traditionally, if you had a PlayStation, you could only play PlayStation games on it.
Correct. Certain titles are only available on the PlayStation. For instance, the Spider-Man games and, you know, games like Uncharted, those are exclusive to the Sony PlayStation ecosystem, whereas Xbox will have Halo and a bunch of other games that you can only play on their devices. That's a common practice. You lose money on the hardware and you make it back with the software, so you are incentivized to build exclusive and high-end, you know, games. By buying the largest game maker, Activision Blizzard, the concern was that they would do the same thing with the existing console ecosystem as well as the nascent cloud gaming applications that are emerging. So the worry is that it's making the market much more stratified, that Microsoft would have so much control that it could basically charge whatever it wanted from consumers and they would have no alternatives or substitutes available.
So the concern is that Microsoft would corner this market before it was mature.
That was the CMA, the UK watchdog's concern, that they would corner it beforehand. You know, it's a definitional difference, ultimately. Is cloud gaming its own platform, or are there going to be platform-only cloud gamers out there in the same that you only have PC gamers out there? By making a deal with Ubisoft, Microsoft has basically said, look, anybody can have this. You know, it is offered the same license to the Activision Blizzard Call of Duty franchise. That's really the main one, the most valuable one in the bunch. In this context, with Nintendo, with Nvidia, and with Sony, they've offered them all the same deal of 10 years of the same content for everybody so that nobody would be left behind in that sense.
So bottom line, how is this acquisition going to affect gamers?
So the immediate impact of this acquisition on the consumer, people playing the games, I believe be beneficial. Microsoft is going to do what every other content streaming platform has done, which is subsidize the content, right? You see the same thing with HBO Max, where you get Game of Thrones for the same amount. Netflix will invest billions in content development. Amazon does the same thing. So just like those companies, Microsoft is subsidizing gameplay for gamers. And I think we're going to see an uptick in consumer adoption and people are going to have a lot of fun, and at least in the short term.
One last thing, Joost. Will people be playing Candy Crush on their Xboxes anytime soon?
I don't think they're going to be playing Candy Crush on their Xbox so much. It's a very different audience. Xbox players and console players is a different demographic than mobile casual gamers. But, you know, the larger strategy in all of this is catering to a broad variety of audiences. What I expect to happen is, in the same way that Game Pass has been launching a lot of releases on its subscription service, we're going to start seeing Call of Duty and we're going to see Diablo and all of the premium Activision titles up for grabs for a much lower price point. And I think that's going to be very exciting.
Joost van Drunen teaches the business of video games at the NYU Stern School of Business. He was updating us on the acquisition by Microsoft of its gaming competitor, Activision Blizzard. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's called The Beautiful Game, but lots of soccer players know well that that beauty can't last forever. Soccer is a physically demanding sport with lots of contact and injuries. But imagine if you could slow it down, way down. The world's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona on a new version of the sport that's letting soccer lovers play on and on and on.
You wouldn't call this 7-on-7 scrimmage fast and furious, but there is action. A forward controls a cross, then takes a shot at goalie Albert Maiker Martin. The ball hits Martin in the shin by chance and bounces away. Just as well, he tells me a moment later. Out here, you have to avoid doing stupid things, he says, adjusting his goalie gloves, like throwing yourself on the ground just to stop a shot. I won't even consider it, he says. There are some strong youngsters out here, guys still in their 50s. Martin is 82. Thin, gray-haired, his right hand trembles slightly. He's here on a recent morning, along with some 30 people, to play walking soccer. As the name suggests, there's one main rule: no running.
No corras. Estás corriendo.
Referee Silvio Sims blows the whistle on 72-year-old Fernando Mayorga, who can't resist going from walk to trot as he tries to reach a slow-rolling pass.
Evitar correr. Claro, después de tantos años corriendo en el fútbol.
Not breaking into a run is the hardest part, Mayorga says, after so many years playing. This is just Mayorga's third day playing walking soccer. He played regular soccer in his native Argentina as a younger man.
Hay que cambiar la mentalidad.
To play this game, he says, you really have to change your mentality. And your expectations and strategy, says referee Sims. Sims co-founded the Spanish chapter of the global walking soccer movement. Here it's known as Wabol. Walking soccer is still soccer in the strictest sense, Sims says, but much safer. When a player has the ball, he says, the opponent can't touch him in any way. In the 2 years since we started this league, he says, we've played a ton of games and never had a single injury. Sims himself is a former pro. He's Australian, but played here with football club Barcelona, or Barça. He says in this game, former greatness and glory will get you nowhere. If I were to bring former Barça legend Lionel Messi down here, he says, he'd be a nobody. Neither his speed nor his skills would help him because of another rule, Sims explains. As soon as you get the ball, you have to pass it. You get just 2 touches total. No dribbling, no slide tackling, and definitely no headers either. The ball can't go above shoulder height. When 51-year-old soccer mom Ingrid Brejade heard about it, she became, well, a walk-on. I wouldn't dare play against these same guys in regular soccer, she says after practice. They run faster, shoot harder. Brejade now has her own team in the Spanish Wabol League. It's one of 12 squads total. And every week, new players join the game. Aging men and women clutching old cleats, wondering if this is real. It is, and it's catching on wherever soccer is played, which is pretty much everywhere. Wabol Spain has a tournament in Morocco later this year, and clubs from France, Senegal, and elsewhere will be competing. But Sim says this is not about winning.
La primera es prohibidísimo enfadarse.
We have two other key rules, he says. Getting mad is forbidden, and you must have fun. That suits goalkeeper Maiker Martin just fine. Like Sims, he played for Barca years ago in exactly 2 games. It was 1961 or 60, he says. I'm no longer sure who we played against, but it was amazing for this 20-year-old kid. Walking soccer is about getting out and running around a bit. It might seem like nothing, he laughs, but at 82, it helps keep the old beer belly at bay. And with that, Martin assumes his goalie stance, hoping the next shot will reach him and not the net. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
From walking soccer now to regular soccer, Morocco has just announced that its national women's team has a new head coach. Jorge Vilda will take over the position. As we've reported, Vilda was sacked by Spain this summer. That was after he was swept up in the scandal around the infamous unwanted kiss that his boss, Luis Rubiales, gave to one of Spain's soccer stars after their World Cup win. Vilda himself was unpopular among the Spanish women's squad, many of whom refused to play under him. They said the coach created an atmosphere that negatively impacted their well-being. The former cryptocurrency mega mogul Sam Bankman-Fried was arrested in the Bahamas last winter, and he's now on trial here in the U.S. The architect of FTX, which operated like a stock exchange for crypto, is being accused of secretly siphoning his customers' money into his cryptocurrency trading firm, Alameda Research. Those allegations are being laid out in court by the prosecution's star witness, Caroline Ellison. She ran Alameda. Senior editor at Wired, Angela Chen, has been following the trial from inside the courtroom. Angela, what is Sam Bankman-Fried, or SBF, being tried for?
In a word, he's being tried for fraud. I don't want to get into the details of the various types of fraud, but the basic accusation is that he took customer deposits from FTX, which is his cryptocurrency exchange, and then essentially gave them to Alameda and used them to prop up Alameda's trades and investments and other expenses. So that last fall, when FTX customers wanted their money back, $8 billion of it wasn't there. It was just gone because he had taken it.
Now, Sam Bankman-Fried is being tried in a U.S. court, but I assume that the charges apply to misdeeds he committed against his customers all over the world. Is that right? And do we know, you know, where his customers were based?
He had customers all over the world. There was FTX US, and there's also the actual company, FTX Bahamas. It worked a lot with international customers. So yes, customers all over the world. And we've already heard in court from victims, one of whom was based in London.
Mm. And has there been any sign of how Sam Bankman-Fried feels about her testimony?
Well, sitting in the court, I have to say, I can only see the back of his head. So what I'm about to say is not firsthand.
Okay.
During Caroline's testimony, the prosecution said, oh, I can see Sam. And he's scoffing. He is laughing at her. And I'm concerned that given the power dynamics, he's trying to intimidate her in some way. Hmm. And essentially asked the defense, you know, can you get your client to cut that out?
Mm. So some of the dynamics that she's testifying to in court potentially carrying over into his reactions in the courtroom.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what has Caroline Ellison, this star witness, talked about so far that's been so damning?
So Caroline was the CEO of Alameda. So that's the sister firm to FTX. And Sam was her boss. And Caroline and him dated on and off. So, you know, massive HR violations, massive ethics violations all over. And essentially what she has said and what the prosecution has barely convincingly argued is that this entire time, even though in name she was the CEO, Sam was directing her to do everything.
So I want to slice off just a little piece of this story and some testimony that's come out that I understand was kind of a tangent in court, but it was about alleged bribery of a foreign official. What happened in Caroline Ellison's telling?
It was just such an absurd digression. So I should be really clear that, you know, that Sam is not being tried for bribery of a foreign official.
Sure.
But during her testimony, Caroline just took us on the story where she said that in 2021, Alameda's trading accounts on these Chinese crypto exchanges got frozen. So for the next year, the FTX team and the Alameda team, they made these increasingly desperate and risky moves to recover that money. First, they hired some lawyers in China. That didn't work. Then they did something that was, I think she said, they were creating accounts in the names of Thai prostitutes to execute trading strategies to move the money. That went by very quickly, but I think it opened a lot of questions that many of us are still thinking about.
Yeah.
And during this entire time, you know, there was this one employee who kept kind of euphemistically saying, you know, why don't we do it my way? And then Ellison said that Alameda eventually paid about $150 million to Chinese officials to get their accounts on the exchanges unfrozen.
Wow. Did Ellison provide an explanation of why SBF did that?
I think they were just desperate. I think they've been trying for a while, and maybe he just had a lot of arrogance. One of the side stories she told was that one of their employees was Chinese and her father was a Chinese official, and she got very mad about this idea. And Sam just ended up yelling at her using a swear word to shut up. I think at some point he just didn't want to hear that the $150 million in bribery was not a good idea, in alleged bribery.
You've been there in the courtroom each day. What about this trial has interested you most personally?
I think it paints a kind of interesting psychological portrait of essentially a bunch of 20-somethings. Now they're 30. And the enormous pressure they were under. You know, Caroline talks about how she made balance sheets and she sent them to Sam, and Sam asked her to, quote, maybe find alternative ways of presenting the information. So she made seven alternatives and sent them to other lending desks. It's interesting to get into the details of it and really see how unprofessional it was. You know, crypto is not well regulated. And from here, you're seeing at a deep level just how badly run this enormous crypto exchange was.
Angela Chen is a senior editor for Wired. You can read her coverage of the Sam Bankman-Fried trial at wired.com. Angela, thanks so much.
Thanks. Have a great day.
Across the globe, people are watching the violence playing out between Israel and Hamas. A lot of what we're seeing is images and videos not on TV or news sites, but social media. And that poses a problem, experts say. Rebecca Rossman has our story.
This dramatic video of a high-rise collapsing has been shared thousands of times on social media over the past few days, with people claiming it depicts Israeli forces bombing buildings in Gaza. Except it's not. It's actually a video of a controlled demolition in China that was filmed in 2021. Then there's the video on TikTok claiming to show a Hamas militant with an Israeli toddler in Gaza, presumably a hostage taken over the weekend. The video, which has been viewed over 3 million times, was actually originally posted in September.
It's incredibly dangerous.
David Gilbert covers online disinformation at Wired magazine. He says the spread of disinformation surrounding the Israel-Hamas war is moving faster and spreading farther than ever before.
We've seen video game footage from a video game called Arma 3, which is being shared as if it's Israeli rocket attacks on Gaza. We've seen attacks from the Syrian regime in Aleppo being repurposed and claiming that it's footage from Gaza.
Clamping down on false or misleading information has become near impossible on one platform in particular, X, formerly known as Twitter. Gilbert says it all has to do with a barrage of changes owner Elon Musk has made to the platform in the last year, changes which incentivize clickbait and misinformation.
The most salacious, most shocking posts will be the ones which are promoted to the top of the feed, because people who pay $8 a month for the blue check mark, X Premium it's called, as part of that subscription, you automatically know that your posts will be prioritized in the feed.
X Premium subscribers can also sign up to receive ad revenue share based on the number of views they get.
A lot of the people who subscribe to X Premium have figured out is that if they post content quickly and in high volume around incidents like the Hamas attack on Israel, then they can very, very quickly rack up hundreds of thousands of millions of engagements and therefore earn money.
On top of that, Musk has made significant cuts to Twitter's content moderation team and dissolved the Trust and Safety Council, a group of more than 100 experts who had volunteered their time to improve safety on the platform.
And our work is made considerably harder today in this conflict because of specific platform changes that Elon Musk put in place.
Emerson Brooking, a senior fellow with the Atlantic Council, is co-author of the book Like War, The Weaponization of Social Media. He says X used to be a place where people directly affected by events could share what they were witnessing with a wide audience.
X mattered for that purpose, but now it is so much harder to use. And as a result, it is so much harder to find the truth and convey it to the public.
And the consequences this creates in times of war can be staggering. Earlier this week, European Commissioner Thierry Breton published an open letter to Elon Musk, warning him that X was potentially violating an EU law known as the Digital Services Act. The law requires social media companies to stop the spread of illegal content, disinformation, and other harmful material. Breton said he would give X 24 hours to respond or risk a major fine. But Jan Penfrat with the nonprofit European Digital Rights says Breton's letter was more or less an empty threat.
There is no such thing as a 24-hour deadline for removing content or even for replying to whatever letter he writes to the CEO of the company.
X's CEO, Linda Yaccarino, did respond, stating the company has removed tens of thousands of pieces of content. But the letter didn't address the broader claims that X is incentivizing users to profit from disinformation. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman.
The International Olympic Committee has confirmed new sports in its lineup: flag football, lacrosse, squash, baseball, softball, and cricket. They'll all be part of the 2028 Olympic Games in Los Angeles. IOC President Thomas Bach made the announcement today.
They will showcase iconic American sports to the world while bringing at the same time international sports to the United States.
Cricket is one of the most popular sports in history, with an estimated 2.5 billion fans around the world. Many of them are currently watching the Men's Cricket World Cup. 10 teams facing off in 10 cities across India. The world's Bianca Hillier catches us up.
Cricket getting a spot in the Olympics is a big deal, but the World Cup is much bigger.
In future, winning the gold is also important, but at the moment, I will prefer winning the World Cup.
Abdul Basit is a lifelong cricket fan and covers the sport for a publication called Cricket Room in Pakistan. There are a few different types of cricket, called formats, and the one being played at this World Cup is called One Day International, or ODI.
Miss those away with six to begin. What a start.
It's similar to the T20 format, which is what will be played at the Olympics, but ODI is a lot longer. Last week, the opening match of the tournament brought the very first upset.
This is a wonderful shot from Ravindra, hitting down the slope, going high and long.
New Zealand's batters showed up big time in Ahmedabad, while England, the reigning champs, delivered a lackluster performance and never recovered. But Basit says England is a seasoned team and still has a chance to go far.
England is that kind of team that they know how to come back.
The most anticipated match of the World Cup is tomorrow, though, when Pakistan and India face off.
Everyone is waiting for this game.
It's the first time the teams have played each other on Indian soil in 7 years. The two countries boast a long-standing rivalry among the biggest in all of sports, and they hold deep political tensions off the field. But in general, that history hasn't impacted relationships in stadiums. Athletes and fans are known to be friendly to each other. In fact, huge crowds welcomed the Pakistani team when they arrived in India for the tournament. Basit points out, though, that people were probably excited to see one player in particular.
Mostly people are the fan of Babar Azam, and they are chatting for Pakistan and Babar Azam.
Babar Azam is Pakistan's captain and is the top ODI batsman in the world right now. He's sure to be in the starting lineup tomorrow. Still, odds are India will win.
They are playing very good cricket. Their batters or their bowlers are performing very well.
And they have the home field advantage.
People will be cheering for only India.
In the Narendra Modi Stadium, which can hold more than 120,000 people, that can make a big difference. If you want to cheer from the States, set your alarm now. It will air on ESPN Plus at 4:30 a.m. Eastern Time. But since games can last more than 7 hours, you may actually be able to sleep in after all. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carolyn Beeler. We'll see you back here on Monday.